It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Budget hearings continue today in Harrisburg as legislators are putting Governor Tom Wolf's spending proposals under the microscope. As the process continues to play out, we're joined by phone from Harrisburg by Governor Wolf. Governor Wolf, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Paul. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start by talking about your proposed sales taxes. Sales taxes are always tricky when it comes to trying to make them as fair as possible. Under your plan, you suggest increasing the sales tax by 0.6% to fund a variety of government programs, including child care and nursing homes. At the same time, you are looking to expand the types of items that are subject to sales tax. Help us to understand the reasoning behind both the increase and the expansion.
A couple things. First of all, the sales tax in Pennsylvania was first established and relatively unchanged since the mid-1950s. And the economy was very different then than it is now. Services were not as important a sector as they are now. And I'm really trying to do, and other states have done this, bring the sales tax into the 21st century by broadening the base and including services that were not included back then. I'm also continuing the exemption for food and clothing and prescription drugs. So I'm trying to keep the things that were hallmarks of Pennsylvania's sales tax in place as I do this. But by broadening the base, it keeps me from raising the tax even more. And I think we're talking about a 0.6% increase as a result of the ability to include things that were not included before. And by doing that, it means that the price of things that are being taxed right now don't go up even more, like automobiles and things like that, hammers, garden hose. So I think this is making the system fair. As to why I'm doing it, I think with the challenges we're facing in Pennsylvania, I'm trying to do a reboot, a reset of our tax system. People, while I was campaigning, told me across the state that they wanted to see property tax relief. My proposal allows that to happen, and actually, on average, a 50% drop in property taxes. Every school district will get a property tax relief. I also heard that people that we need to address the budget deficit. We can't keep playing games. The state, the Commonwealth, is essentially out of cash. So we simply can't keep doing what we're doing, that is consume public goods and not pay for them. And we've been doing that for years and years. It's a bipartisan thing. But we need to finally address that and be honest about the deficit. And I want to do that. And I think part of that is the sales tax ended up with, I think, a fair system of taxation and one that is still modest compared to other states, but one that finally addresses the reality of the budget challenge we have faced for years.
Speaking of taxes, Governor, you have proposed a 5% severance tax on the fracking industry. Some are asking what this tax will do to protect the people and the environment of Pennsylvania. How would you answer that question?
I think that's absolutely essential. I want to have a very strong and healthy gas industry. And at the same time, I want to protect the natural environment that gas industry operates in. So there are four things I want to spend that money on. First, I want to return the money and continue the funding for localities that allow drilling and are impacted by drilling. This would take the place of the impact fee. Second, I want to make sure that we are spending, investing enough in the regulatory apparatus to make sure that permits are being given on a timely basis, but also that we're enforcing the regulations that do exist to protect our water and air. So $10 million additional dollars I'm proposing in my budget for the Department of Environmental Protection. Third, I want some of this money to be used for building a bridge to a sustainable energy future so that about $50 to $60 million a year in my budget will be devoted to funding of $675 million bond issue that would allow us to continue to do things that were done back in the old days in terms of tax credits, tax incentives, and other grants that help us build a bridge to a sustainable energy future and encourage photovoltaic cells and wind and other types of renewable, sustainable energy. And then finally, I want to use what's left, hundreds of millions of dollars from a 5% severance tax to be used for funding education. I think those four things are really important and the things that we need to do to make sure this industry works for all of us.
On the topic of education, you have proposed across-the-board funding increases, but questions have come up about issues of disparity. Some critics say that your proposal makes the rich schools richer and you still have inequity. How do you plan to address this?
First of all, that was another thing I heard throughout the campaign, that we need to make sure we invest in education, that we invest adequately. And that'll vary from district to district. So I've tried to be sensitive to that, and I actually used a system that has been used for a number of years now in the Commonwealth with the way we allocate the casino funds to make sure that the districts receive the money in proportion to the financial need. Right now, we actually fund education because of the heavy reliance on the property tax. It just turns out that the poorest school districts end up getting the least and have the highest tax burden with their millage rate. I want to try to make that fair, and I said throughout the campaign that I want to try to get the state share of funding public education to 50%, which it hasn't been since the early 70s, and my proposal actually accomplishes it. So it does make investments in education in different ways. Rural and urban school districts, some of whom get very big tax increases, increases in education funding. But every school district gets a reduction in the property tax. And my hope is the outcome of this is that every child in Pennsylvania has a chance to get a good education, regardless of her or his zip code, her or his school district.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Governor Tom Wolf. Governor, you have imposed a moratorium on the death penalty. What went into your decision to impose this moratorium, and will it survive the lawsuit filed by the Philadelphia District Attorney? And I believe there may be some other legal challenges involved as well.
Yeah, I'm confident it'll survive the challenge. The governor has a constitutional right to grant a reprieve, which is what I've done here. A moratorium is something that is unconstitutional, but I'm granting a reprieve, which I have the right to do. And the reason I'm doing that is because I want to make sure that we take this step that you cannot retreat from. If we had the death penalty in Pennsylvania, that it actually makes sense. And I think it's a good chance to actually ask the question whether it does make sense. There's a bipartisan commission headed by two senators that's been meeting since 2011, and I'm not sure when they will make their report, but I think we owe it to them to read that report. And in the meantime, hold off on on executions to make sure that if they find that this isn't economical, that it doesn't serve as a deterrent, and that it's unfairly implemented, any or all of those things, I think, should make it questionable for all of us as to whether it's the right punishment for criminals who deserve severe punishment. But is this the right punishment?
Do you see it being eliminated altogether at some point, perhaps while you're in office?
It could be. I mean, other states have done that, but that's a decision that I think the Commonwealth as a whole has to come to. I think we need to have a robust conversation, and we need to look at the facts, and we need to take a look at this commission, again, a bipartisan commission, to make sure that we're making this this penalty that it is the right thing for a place like Pennsylvania to do.
Final question, Governor. You have opted to transition from Governor Corbett's Healthy PA alternative to a full Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. What happens if the Supreme Court decides to unravel Obamacare? How would that impact Pennsylvania?
Well, the Insurance Department is working on a backup plan, but I got to say, and I'm not a lawyer, but I got to say, just a reasonable look at the facts of the case, and it seems to me that the court really the outcome, the way they're going to rule is that, that actually what we're doing here in Pennsylvania actually does make sense. But I'm working on a backup plan, and if the court does rule unexpectedly that you need to have a statewide exchange, then and that the federal exchange does not qualify, then I'll deal with that and make sure that we have something in place. So that, again, my primary goal here is to make sure that Pennsylvania is doing what it needs to do for the people who don't have access to health care, health insurance, and to make sure that the people in that need are have continuing access to health care, and that they don't have a disruption in service.
Governor Tom Wolf with us by phone from Harrisburg. Governor Wolf, we look forward to speaking with you again soon. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us.
Paul, thank you for having me on. It's been great being back.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been a year since 2,000 people gathered downtown calling on UPMC to pay its workers a minimum wage of $15 an hour and grant them the right to form a union. Today, Pittsburgh City Council was set to vote on a resolution to stand with those workers. City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak is one who supports that resolution, and she joins us now by phone. Councilwoman Rudiak, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. Thank you for having me here today.
That vote on the resolution was taken this morning. How did it turn out?
It was passed unanimously.
Was that at all a surprise to you?
Not necessarily a surprise. We have a council that understands how the employees of UPMC impact the neighborhoods which we represent and the neighborhoods in which these employees live. And we see the connection between the wages and the benefits that these employees receive and how that affects the quality of life in our neighborhoods.
How would you characterize this ongoing battle between these workers and UPMC?
Gosh, that's a very good question. I think it's been a long and frustrating road for many of the workers. There have actually been at least three employees that have been fired for their efforts, their union efforts, and the National Labor Relations Board has actually ruled in favor of the workers, giving them back pay as well as reinstating their jobs. Of course, UPMC is appealing that. But I'm just going to quote what the National Labor Relations Board judge said. He said that he called the UPMC's efforts egregious and widespread misconduct so as to demonstrate a general disregard for employees' statutory rights. So it's pretty intense.
You have been front and center in your support for these workers in their quest for a $15 an hour minimum wage and also their quest to form a union. Why have you been so out front and outspoken on this particular issue, Councilwoman Rudiak?
Let's see, part of it is because, frankly, my family goes back into the union movement. My grandfather was one of the original founders of the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, which was the Steelworkers Union. And I think that we're seeing another chapter in Pittsburgh history where we're trying to build the middle class. And, you know, it's something that I've always been interested in, always been concerned about. And also, I mean, frankly, there's a common sense aspect to all of this that I think we need to keep in mind. And I'm the chair of the Finance and Law Committee, right? So I'm always looking for ways to balance the city's budget and to make sure that our economy is running smoothly. And we know that a base wage of $15 an hour for UPMC workers would result in $75 million more in the hands of these service workers, which would significantly not only improve their lives and pull them out of poverty, but go back directly into our neighborhoods. It would result in up to $53 million of new economic activity as a result of increased spending, and even it would result in $1 million of new revenue for the Pittsburgh Public Schools. So we know that when employees are paid a living wage, that everybody benefits.
Some might ask, is this the city council's fight to fight? Why should this governing body be involved?
This is absolutely city council's fight to fight. This is what I was elected to do when I first ran for office. Actually, the platform that I still maintain to this day is to protect our neighborhoods from crime and neglect and to rebuild our business district and restore public trust. And I think that fighting for the rights of UPMC workers and, mind you, the taxpayers fits directly into that platform. Because, again, when people have more money in their pockets, they're able to afford to buy that house or fix that roof or get that car or, you know, pay those bills and improve our neighborhoods. And maybe, you know, they're able to frequent the neighborhoods in our main street corridors. And, I mean, there's this whole other aspect, too, of UPMC and how it's the largest landowner and employee in Allegheny County but doesn't pay taxes. And, you know, we have hundreds of millions of dollars a year of property taxes that are not being paid. So clearly that is part of my purview as a city council person to hold our region's largest employer accountable in all these aspects.
What has the response been from UPMC? And by the way, we invited a representative from UPMC to join this conversation and received no response. What response has the city received on this?
I would say for the most part, it's been they've been invited to the conversation. I actually had a public hearing a couple years ago on UPMC issues from workers' rights to the land use issue, and I invited representatives from UPMC, and they did not appear. I think that a couple weeks ago, the chair of the board had actually called UPMC detractors quote-unquote nuts. That literally happened by a corporate board member. So it's either met with silence or derision, unfortunately.
So going forward, what do you want to see happen? You know, how can there be some movement on this? What has to happen?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, we know that UPMC continues to intimidate workers, continues to conduct illegal surveillance of workers, and you know, there's continued discrimination amongst workers who are organizing for the union. So we clearly would want that type of behavior to stop. And I know that the organizations that I'm working with will do everything in their power to hold UPMC accountable and the legal system to make them stop. And at the end of the day, we just want UPMC to allow their workers to do what they would like and organize as they are legally able to do under federal law. And again, right now, unfortunately, the company is intimidated workers to the point where I think a lot of workers are afraid that they may lose their jobs if they speak up at work, which is really stunning.
We're talking with City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Just about a minute or so left, Councilwoman. One of the things that's been brought up is that OSHA is currently investigating UPMC over the chemical oxycide after workers at UPMC Presbyterian complained that the chemical used to clean patients' rooms was making them sick.
Right.
What about this particular aspect of this fight?
Again, you know, this is something that the workers would like to have a voice at work, and it's something that as members of a union, they would be able to have a larger voice on some of the products that they use on a daily basis at work. I believe that there was a survey done of UPMC workers, and most of them actually indicated that they had suffered negative effects from this oxycide. That is very, very concerning to me, and it's something that I sincerely hope that OSHA investigates to its fullest extent.
Will there be more hearings, demonstrations? Last year, as I mentioned, there were 2,000 people in the streets showing their support for the resolution that the city council, in fact, passed today. standing with those workers. What do you see happening in the future?
You know, we're still working on it. Frankly, I think right now for a lot of the workers, it's a matter of just keeping the faith, honestly. And that's part of why we do what we do, because we want the workers to keep the faith. Three of the workers who were fired from their jobs for wearing, you know, a union button or talking about the union, you know, they're still looking for ways to support their families. And so we had a fundraiser for them a couple months ago. So right now it's about keeping the faith and staying strong and, you know, about, frankly, going back to the drawing board and strategizing on how we continue to support these workers. But there's some interesting work that I'll be doing behind the scenes to do some more analysis of how UPMC affects taxpayers and their status. So one thing at a time. I won't unveil everything now, but one thing at a time.
City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak joining us by phone to talk about today's resolution passed unanimously by the City Council, calling on UPMC to pay its workers a minimum wage of $15 an hour and grant them the right to form a union. We invited a representative from UPMC to join this conversation and received no response. Councilwoman Rudiak, thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up, we'll celebrate St. Patrick's Day by taking you to Dublin and a tour of the Guinness Storehouse. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's St. Patrick's Day, and on this day, when all things Irish are being celebrated, there's bound to be a toast or two done with a pint of Guinness. For many Americans, and in fact for folks all over the world, no St. Patrick's Day would be complete without a Guinness or two. Joining us all the way from Dublin, Ireland, with a history of the ale, is Evelyn Roach. She's media relations manager for the Guinness Storehouse. Evelyn Roach, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, and a Cade Mila Fáilte to you and your listeners to Ireland.
Ah, thank you. A little Gaelic. How would you translate that?
100,000 welcomes. Cade Mila Fáilte.
Oh, thank you. And 100,000 right back at you.
Thank you.
Let's imagine that you're taking us on a tour of the Guinness Storehouse. What should connoisseurs of Guinness know about it?
Well, I think that the first thing about the Guinness Storehouse is that we're actually located right in the heart of the St. James's Gate Brewery site. So literally, when you're looking out the windows from the storehouse, you're looking out onto where Guinness is currently brewed. And we're in a beautiful old building that dates back over 100 years that used to house the fermentation process for Guinness. So one of the, where the yeast was actually added into the beer. So it's an old industrial building that's been just fabulously retrofitted into the home of Guinness. So when visitors come in here, and we welcome visitors from absolutely all over the world, they come in and they learn about the ingredients that go into Guinness, how it's brewed, a little bit about the world famous Guinness advertising, and we've 7 different floors actually of exhibition space, which culminates in our 360 degree rooftop bar, which we call our gravity bar, which overlooks the city of Dublin. So your visit to the storehouse isn't complete without a pint in hand looking out over the city.
Man, that sounds spectacular. 7 floors, you say?
7 floors, yeah. I say it's a beautiful old building. It's actually one of the first, technically, it's one of the first skyscrapers to have been built in the British Isles. So it's a very, very tall building. And perched on top, as I say, we've put a new addition, is our 360-degree gravity bar. It's actually the highest public viewing point in the city of Dublin. So I think visitors, when they go to any city, one of the first things they want to do is get the bird's-eye view out over the city. So we can accommodate that with a pint of Guinness in hand.
And is it true that the Guinness Storehouse holds the honor of being Ireland's number one tourist attraction?
Yes, I'm delighted to say it is. Every year we welcome, or last year rather, we welcome just over 1.2 million visitors from around the world. And actually visitors from the US make up the single largest nationality of visitors that we welcome here to the storehouse, but literally we welcome visitors from absolutely all four corners of the world who want to come to Dublin, want to come to the storehouse to experience, I suppose, that little bit of Irish culture and what Guinness means to us here in Ireland.
And what was that estimate of how many people visit the storehouse each year?
So last year we welcomed 1.2 million visitors.
1.2, my goodness. And I understand that they used to give you tours through the brewery where Guinness is actually made, but they now no longer do that.
No, we no longer do that. And I suppose if you can imagine that we have 1.2 million visitors coming to here to the home of Guinness, it just wouldn't be feasible to take them through the actual production site itself. But we do bring the brewing process very much to life within the visitor experience here in the Guinness Storehouse. And I say because we're located right in the heart of the St. James's Gate Brewery, that the brewery literally surrounds you. So as a visitor, you're seeing the buildings, maybe not quite inside the buildings, but you're seeing the buildings where Guinness is being brewed right around you when you come to visit the storehouse.
Sounds like it's a pretty good precaution to take, is just, you know, to keep people sort of on the perimeter.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's just that the volume of people, we just wouldn't be able to accommodate them through the actual process. But they say they don't miss out. We do explain it in full detail.
We're talking with Evelyn Roach. She's Media Relations Manager for the Guinness Storehouse for the famous Guinness brand and talking about what undoubtedly for many is their favorite beverage for St. Patrick's Day. Now, Evelyn, let's talk about the process that goes into the brewing of Guinness. And you know, Guinness is a very distinctive beer. It's distinctive. It has a distinctive look. It's very dark. It has that tan-colored head on top of it, and it kind of settles into that fine, very, very robust flavored beer that for many has a kind of a bitter taste. I'm curious, you know, how this whole concoction was conjured up, I'm guessing centuries ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Arthur Guinness is our founder, and he laid down a lease on the brewery site here at St. James's Gate in the year 1759. So we've been brewing Guinness and the dark beer that is defined by Guinness for over 250 years. And the recipe really hasn't changed a huge amount throughout that time. So if you hold a pint of Guinness up to the light, we would say that it's a ruby red colour rather than necessarily black and white. And the ruby red actually comes from the colour from the roasted barley. So we just have four natural ingredients that go into making Guinness. We have barley, hops, water and yeast. And actually part of that barley then is roasted, almost like as if you were roasting coffee beans. And that's what gives Guinness that beautiful, rich, ruby red hue. And actually it's what gives Guinness that roasted flavour as well, is our roasted barley. And it's just those four natural ingredients that go into making Guinness. And as I say, really the recipe hasn't changed a huge amount over the past 200 years.
I'm going to have to hold my Guinness, and I certainly intend to have one tonight. I'm going to have to hold that up to the light and look for the ruby red because I guess I've never really noticed it before. And probably most people haven't, but they'll be looking for it now.
Very good. Absolutely. Do hold it up to the light and you'll just see that beautiful red hue, ruby red hue coming through. It's not pitch black. So it's ruby red is the color we call it.
We'll all raise our glasses together and look for the ruby red. Now, I'm curious, Evelyn, what was the reaction that people had to this very distinctive tasting beer 250 years ago when it first came out?
Well, actually, people would have had a really positive reaction to it, and so much so, one of the reasons why Guinness is really known so well around the world today is that early on in its history, we started exporting our beer all around the world. So, for example, in the United States, we have a record of our beer being exported to the States as early as the 1820s. So from a very early period in our history, not only was Guinness being enjoyed by Irish people, but actually we were exporting to the four corners of the world by the mid-1800s. So it really is a beer that's been beloved for worldwide for nigh on 200 years.
And who are some of the famous people, maybe in America, maybe in Ireland or England, who have maybe lent their name to the cause of supporting Guinness, or testimony that they love this beer more than any other?
Yeah, well, we do. We actually, here in the Guinness Storehouse, we have a wall of fame of many different celebrities from all walks of life, from politicians right through to sports stars, who are very happy to enjoy a pint of Guinness. So most famously, when President Obama was over in Ireland 3 years ago, he raised a pint. We've had the Queen of England visiting us here in the Guinness Storehouse, also being photographed in front of a pint. We've had Hollywood celebrities, the likes of Paul Rudd, for example, visiting Guinness Storehouse as well. All absolutely learning about the pint, but actually learning about Guinness's role in Dublin and in Irish culture. Absolutely, the great and the good come to visit us here in the Storehouse.
That is fantastic. Now, would you tell us about the connection to Guinness Ale and the Guinness Book of World Records?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting one, because I think everybody is familiar with the pint of Guinness, and everybody's familiar with the name, the Guinness Book of Records. But they actually there is a link between them. And in the early 1950s, the managing director of Guinness at the time was a gentleman called Sir Hugh Beaver. And he was down at a shooting party on a big landed estate in Ireland one afternoon. And the shooting party was shooting game birds, wild game. And a bird was flying overhead and flew very fast. And that led to a conversation later on that night around the fire, presumably with a glass of Guinness in hand, about what the fastest game bird in the world was. And nobody knew the answer. So the managing director went away and had this thought that actually, wouldn't it be a fantastic idea to create a book of facts? So the greatest, the smallest, the tallest, and create this a book that would hold all those facts. And the idea initially was that it would be given to every barman in the UK and Ireland to hold behind the bar to solve any sort of bar disputes that might happen among any of the consumers within the bar. So that's where it originally started off. 1955 saw the first edition being published, and it's just been a huge success ever since.
And was it with the idea in mind that, you know, you could settle disputes and not have any, you know, that it would head off any potential barroom brawls?
I think so. I've heard it being described as the Google of the 1950s. So I think that's a very appropriate link.
On this St. Patrick's Day, Evelyn, tell us what the Guinness Storehouse is doing to celebrate.
Well, what we do here in the Storehouse, we don't just celebrate St. Patrick's Day itself, but we have a four-day festival which culminates in St. Patrick's Day. So again, we're looking to welcome visitors from absolutely all over the world, and we have extra entertainment on here in the Storehouse. So in addition to the tour, which I mentioned earlier, we have live music. We have a ceilidh. So a ceilidh is an Irish dancing, where we are doing a ceilidh demonstration of Irish dancing and then inviting people in, the visitors, to come and partake. So that's always a really good bit of fun. And then we have some of the marching bands who are coming over to Dublin, especially from the States, actually, to march in the main Dublin City Parade tomorrow, are coming in to visit us here in the Storehouse with all their instruments. So really, really good fun tomorrow for St. Patrick's Day.
And so, Evelyn, will you be having a Guinness or two maybe today?
Absolutely. We'd be very happy and very proud to be raising a pint of Guinness on St. Patrick's Day. And we'll be doing it here in the Storehouse in the Gravity Bar overlooking the city of Dublin. No better place to do it.
Evelyn Roach is Media Relations Manager for the Guinness Storehouse. Evelyn, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Paul, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you and your listeners.
And we'll have more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
Doug Rare started graduate school at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in 1978.
It was a fun time, but you had to be aware of your surroundings because you could end up in a very bad situation.
Rare is not talking about his religion classes.
I got involved in the bar scene because my work study fell through.
Almost every night, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m., Rare worked at the Tender Trap, a gay bar located on South Highland Avenue in East Liberty.
Oh my God, it was exhilarating, it was liberating.
At the time, Rare needed a little liberation. A fellow student said he was being targeted for being homosexual. He asked Rare to formally come out to the school. Risking alienation, Rare wrote a letter to the administration, and unfortunately, his identity was leaked.
My life for the remainder of the school year was very interesting. You know, students were they were stealing my food from the communal kitchen. I would walk into a bathroom and they would just run out, and it's like, don't flatter yourself.
Rare's story is one of thousands collected by Harrison Apple, co-director of the Pittsburgh Queer History Project.
What our project really tries to do is to preserve a bygone era from the 60s to the 90s of gay and lesbian life in Pittsburgh.
The project began as an undergraduate research fellowship at CMU in the summer of 2012. A friend invited Apple to excavate an abandoned after-hours club in East Liberty. There, he uncovered the remnants of a nearly extinct ecosystem of gay clubs and bars.
It was a time capsule. There was drinks on the bar, soda cans that had been sitting there so long that the acid had eaten through the aluminum. There were keys from an employee of the Nabisco Baking Company, clip-on earrings. I know every kind of brand of cigarette that somebody smoked at that club.
The crux of the excavation was pulled from a found wallet. It was a membership card for Travelers, an after-hours club run by the fulcrum of the city's LGBT community.
His whole name was Robert Johns, but everybody knew him as Lucky.
Lucky was a charmer. Openly gay, he worked in a series of bars around the city and developed a loyal following that helped him obtain a social club charter. All of Pittsburgh's clubs, and there were hundreds of them, the Elks, the Moose, veterans of foreign wars, required a charter to operate. A chartered club could obtain a liquor license to serve registered members and operate after hours.
Anybody who's ever tried to buy a six-pack of beer in Pittsburgh will tell you our liquor codes are insane. And we actually use them to work to our advantage.
Tim Haggerty is Harrison Apple's advisor and director of the Humanities Scholars Program in CMU's Dietrich College of Humanities and Social Sciences.
These private clubs were built for what we think of as fraternal interests. And we were just a really big fraternity. And what Lucky or Robert Johns saw was that that was a loophole through which one could have a gay club that would not be a public nuisance because of its private membership.
Just 40 years ago, serving a drink to a gay person could be a criminal offense. And most club and bar patrons preferred a degree of anonymity, says Rare.
Nobody ever used a last name. I mean, in general, it was one of those things, you know, you forgot just in case.
The private nature of the clubs allowed gay life to develop in relative safety, says Haggerty.
For the most part, many of the people who went to these clubs were closeted, except for maybe the one night or two nights a week where they went out to these clubs and had a gay identity. The world was different, and you negotiated that world differently.
Many in Pittsburgh's working-class gay community didn't join the era's out-migration. Instead, maybe alone, maybe behind a bar, maybe at a cruising spot, they found a way to live within communities they'd been born into, in a society opposed to a central part of their identities. Apple is working to make this twilight world of Pittsburgh's history better known.
It's so important to do it now. A lot of these people are getting older. A lot of people are passing away. And if we don't do this work, it likely will never happen.
For 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When it comes to discussions about women in the workplace, the conversation veers to having it all, leaning in, or opting out. However, less is said about the contributions women make to their organization. Here to recognize and celebrate their role in the workplace is Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. Rebecca, happy St. Patrick's Day. How are you?
I'm great, Paul, and you look fabulous in this lovely green tie for those our listeners who can't see you. But let me just tell them, you look awesome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you have green earrings.
Quartz earrings, yeah. So we're in the green.
You took them off. You took them off to put your headphones
on. Right.
So, what are they made of?
Quartz. They're actually a woman business owner made these earrings for me, which is what we're talking about today.
How apropos. Yeah. Well, this is Women's History Month. So tell us the history behind this particular designation.
Okay. So Women's History Month highlights the contributions of women to the we look at women, women's events in history, and we look at women who have contributed to contemporary society. It's celebrated in March in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and in Australia. And initially, it started in 1981 as just a week. But in 1987, after being petitioned by the National Women's History Project, Congress designated the month of March in 1987 as Women's History Month. So we went from a week to a month, because certainly a week is just not enough, Paul.
And what is International Women's Day exactly? How does it connect to Women's History Month?
Right. So what happened was International Women's Day, which always occurs on March 8th, and a lot happened this year, and people probably started to see it, and then the connection to Women's History Month. All of those come together in March. Initially, International Women's Day was observed starting since, I think, the 1990s, Paul, and it was really a time of great expansion and turbulence in the industrialized world. We saw booming population growth. We saw the rise of more radical ideologies. And in 1910, at the second annual International Conference of Working Women in Copenhagen, a proposal was made that every year in every country there should be a celebration to really press for the demands of women. And that was the origination of that. So annually now on March 8th, we see thousands of events throughout the world to really inspire women to celebrate their achievements. We see political rallies, business conferences, government activities. We see networking events, local conferences. We see artisan fairs. And I followed a lot of Twitter chat on March 8th this past year to really see what was going on internationally. And it was quite amazing. I was very impressed, Paul.
And you said something that sparked my curiosity about 1910. Mm-hmm. What do we know about what women were doing in the working world then? I mean, there was that glass ceiling that prevented so many women from doing things they wanted to do, but there were opportunities out there and there were very enterprising women.
Well, there certainly were. I don't think that we saw the same types of executive issues that we deal with now and women getting to the top of corporations. We saw a lot of basic women working on the lines in factories. And at that time, really just getting basic needs met and demands met was really critical. We saw women very definitely helping with war efforts, depending on what countries they were in, contributing in many different ways to the industrialization of countries. So the efforts that they were undergoing then and the issues that they faced are certainly different than the issues we face now, but some of the basic underlying principles are same, like equal pay, reasonable hours, those kind of things.
And another thing to wrap our minds around, which when you think about it, it's pretty amazing, is that the things that were happening in 1910, this is still 10 years before women had the right to vote.
That's right. That is right.
In the United States, anyway.
Right. It's sort of hard to believe that we never always could vote. But that might be a discussion for another day, Paul.
Right. Well, okay. We're talking with our business correspondent, Rebecca Harris. She's director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. Are there specific business-related opportunities during Women's History Month?
There are many, Paul. And what I wanted to do was to also set the context a little bit about the number of women in business and look at that. So here's the current situation. Women are starting businesses at a higher rate now than they ever were, Paul. And women-owned businesses are among the fastest growing in the United States. There are now 9.1 million women-owned businesses. These firms generate $1.4 trillion in revenue. And they employ close to 8 million people. And all this information is from the American Express Open, which is a report that's issued every year. We have a lot of these links on your website. But here's the sort of the bleaker side of this. Despite the proliferation of women-owned businesses, there's still so much more to be done because women now only employ close to 6% of the nation's workforce, and we just contribute under 4% of business revenues. So what we're really seeing is we're seeing more women entering the business world, but what's really needed is the support to help the women who are in the business world really get to the next level, to hire more people, to grow their enterprises, and that's what really needs to happen next.
And I'm not sure what kind of a breakdown you have on this, but when you said it was 9.1
million women-owned businesses in the United States.
And what kind of businesses are they in?
The largest industries that these businesses in predominantly tend to be more service-oriented, and we're not seeing those in the construction industry, but much more in the service-oriented industry in education and services. Those types of things is where we're seeing the biggest growth, which makes sense because it doesn't require a lot of plant and equipment to get these industries going. And one of the toughest things that women-owned companies deal with is access to credit and getting adequate funding to start their businesses. And so that's a barrier to entry. And so service businesses are usually easier to start.
What can you tell us about what's being done locally to observe Women's History Month? Yeah. What's happening here in Pittsburgh and the surrounding area?
We have some great local stuff. So first of all, if you're not able to make any of the local events, the SBA is doing some great has some great opportunities. They're hosting actually a Twitter chat this afternoon to help women entrepreneurs. So at 3 p.m. Eastern time, their chat hashtag is hashtag SBA chat. And so we have that information again on your website at 3 p.m., which is great. They're hosting as well the SBA, and the SBA has a whole women's website to help people who are women starting and growing their businesses, how to take your women-owned business global, and also information about Encore Entrepreneurship, which is for women who are over 50 who are really looking to launch a second business, which is becoming more and more popular. But locally here, the Women's History Month Small Business Counseling for Women is taking place at the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh at tomorrow, which is March 19th. Is that correct?
Tomorrow's the 18th.
Okay, right. The next day at 12:15. The Duquesne Women in Philosophy 2015 conference is being held at Duquesne University, and that's on March 21st. And so they're really looking at the role of women in times of crisis. They're looking at progress. And March 22nd, the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in the Earth Theater is looking at the whole celebration of the power of one voice and looking at the life of Rachel Carson, which is really someone who hails from Chatham University, and looking at featured historians and writers and scientists in the environmental context. And certainly women have been very influential in looking at the environment and realizing the effects of the environment on themselves, their children. And then on the 31st of March, we have Celebrate and Share, which is on a Tuesday, which is titled Women's Voices, Hear Them Speak. And the goal is to continue to build a platform where women can celebrate their talents and achievements and really look to forward each other. So we have a lot of great things going on.
And you mentioned that there is advice available for women entrepreneurs who want to expand their business globally.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would be some ways of doing that, or a way or two?
Well, what we're seeing, and actually tomorrow the White House is sponsoring a whole seminar on exporting businesses and how you can really export more. And the White House is looking at things like exporting services, not just looking at exporting manufactured products. And so when you're looking at what you might have because of this whole virtual platform that we all live on every day, there are opportunities to export products that you have that you might not even have thought about. And so that's a great opportunity to get into business abroad where you might have thought, oh, I don't know, somebody, I do some counseling services. Well, maybe that can happen abroad as well. Maybe in Ireland.
Maybe. Well, this would be the day to be talking about that.
This would be the day to talk about that.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Rebecca.
Rebecca
Harris, Director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University and our business contributor to the program. Good to have her back. Good to have you with us today on Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow on the program, our monthly visit with Mayor Peduto on the show. Also, an interview with film director Jonathan Demme, who, of course, directed Silence of the Lambs here in Pittsburgh. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.